I trust you to go in and get my dog from the house while it's burning. I'm trusting you to come into my home in the middle of the night. I'm here alone, and I'm going to let three big men with, you know, suitcases walk into my door, which I left propped open because I trust the fire service. Man, that is a treasure beyond belief in the human experience.
What's up, my brothers and sisters? Welcome to the Fireground Fitness Podcast, where we talk about all things pertaining to life on and off the fireground. The views and the opinions expressed are those of your host and our guest. Today, we sit down with Heather Marquise of the Alameda County Fire Department. We talk about her journey through life growing up as a military brat, her travels to Nicaragua as a young 20-year-old. We talk about her steps toward the fire service, and lastly, her project on recruitment and retention that she did while attending the Naval Postgraduate School. We cover all of this and so much more. Thanks for tuning in. Please enjoy. So Heather, thank you for taking time. You happen to be here in Arizona, which is a fantastic opportunity for us to sit down and talk. I want to talk about your EFO paper. You talk about recruitment and retention, specifically targeting women and some of the obstacles. And I want to talk about that. Before we dive into that, though, I want to talk about who you are and you know, some of the experiences you've had, and et cetera, and what makes you what makes up who you are each day, and how we got here.
All right. Well, thank you. It is so nice to meet you. And before I say anything about myself, I want to tell you the nicest thing I heard about you yesterday.
What's that?
I asked someone who you recently met. I said, tell me about Rain Gray. And they said, you know what's special about him? He will make you feel like you're the most important person in the room.
Aww.
And I think that is such a great quality. And I love that you are, as a fire chief, I'll bet you do that for your people. So I like to hear that.
Well,
so thank you. And I'm already experiencing
that.
Blushing. I really enjoy talking to you, and we're having a hard time even getting started because it's fun. We've only met before on the phone, and then I happen to be in Arizona right now. I just spoke yesterday at the Women's Symposium.
Yes.
So I was invited down. I'm a division chief in California in Alameda County, which is east of San Francisco. I'm in a metro department. We have about 350 members, run about 48,000 calls a year.
Have you been with that agency your entire career?
I have. Well, technically, yes, only because we're a consolidated agency, not unlike LA County or other consolidates. I came from Emeryville Fire, started in 2006, so I've been in for 18 years. We consolidated into Alameda County in 2012. Yeah. Which that actually, I have a gift for you today. I'm going to give you the history book I wrote.
And ooh, fun.
Because I'm from a consolidated agency, we had 100 years of history. And then as we came in as like stepchildren into this family, our backstory was getting lost. And so I ended up archiving all the rest of the agency's history and backstories for the last 150 years before that. So anyway, we're only a 30-year-old agency, but with 150-year-old family members.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Uh-huh.
So a history book.
Yeah.
Tell me about that a little bit. So Okay. Did you have any writing experience before that, or is this your first stab at writing?
Well, so it's funny. I transitioned. So a little bit about myself. I grew up in a military family. My dad's Canadian. I grew up on Guam and Chicago, Spokane.
Okay, hold on.
You're Canadian.
I'm Canadian. What part of Canada?
My dad's from Penticton, British Columbia.
Oh my gosh. Well, I say, oh my gosh, because I came from BC. I grew up in BC, in Vancouver, or Burnaby.
Oh, that's Canadian manners. That's what people are talking about. I try to teach my children Canadian manners. They're exceptional. Yeah, your default is niceness. It's just it's a wonderful genetic trait to have.
Yeah, and I have a tendency to say I'm sorry too much.
Oh, I am. We're going to apologize all day then. I mean, I'm sorry that I even interrupted you. Here we go. So, Canadian story on one side. My mom's family's American, but he was U.S. military, kind of like Vietnam era. And so, born in Linwood, California, right next to Compton, which I try to claim every now and then when I'm trying to be hard. And then we lived on Guam, and then Chicago, where he was a drill instructor, Spokane, Washington, and then Astoria, Oregon, which is Columbia River, in the Goonies era. I was there when Goonies was filmed. And then back to Alameda he became an intelligence agent. And I went through eighth grade through high school in Alameda, which kind of like landed me in the Bay Area. So that's what got me there. And then from there, I took off and grabbed a backpack and moved to Central America by myself.
What are your memories of moving around as a kid? Like, did you have any things that sticks out to you as like this was a pivotal point for me or takeaway?
Oh, yeah. Like I can tell you the pivotal point which brought me to the fire service, which is for some odd reason, I feel like I've been like in the disaster path. Hmm. Like all these epic natural disasters, I was there for them. And so like I was in Longview, California, when Mount St. Helens blew up.
Oh, yeah.
I saw Mount St. Helens blow up with my own eyes, you know, and then I had just crossed over the Cypress structure when the Loma Prieta earthquake happened and, pancaked the freeway and killed so many people. And I just have had this weird experience where I've been landed in interesting parts of the world when crazy things have happened. So yeah. I do feel like it was my 18th birthday and I was in the Oakland Hills. And about a half a mile away from me, I saw a little column of smoke, and that would become the Oakland Hills fire.
Oh, wow.
That was 1991 on my 18th birthday. It happened right next to where I was. I was in Kensington and it started half a mile away, and then an apocalypse followed that, as you know.
Wow. Well, and you said you started traveling.
Yeah.
So here's my question. Did you travel because you were trying to run away from all these disasters, or did you travel? Did you just have a sense of wanderlust because as a kid, you guys moved around a lot?
No, you nailed it. As a child, when you do move a lot, you start to become, you develop characteristics of adaptability for sure. Because when you're in the new kid at school, you got to figure that out.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But then I also just have had kind of an intrinsic, like long memory of all these different ways of living and an interest in keeping going. So as soon as I got out of high school, I bailed and I started walking and I moved to Costa Rica and Nicaragua.
Okay, so let's talk about that a little bit, because what an awesome thing. I was never a traveler, and my wife, one of the topics of conversations in our house for the last 30 years is, we need to travel. And we got married really young, and then got afraid. We didn't have any money, so we'd like, we're not doing this. We're scared to death. Plus, I was in the Marine Corps, so how much time off did I actually have? Hardly any. Anyway, so we recently, in the last few years, started traveling, and it's fantastic,
yeah.
Right? Really love it. So when you started traveling, you were right out of high school?
Yeah.
So let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah. So, it's funny. We talk about grit, like in the fire service. It's one of the components of success and humor. Mm-hmm. Those are the two things that will get you through a healthy fire service career, is grit and humor. But if you want to develop your grit, like go to Central America in the 90s, right after, like, you know, when Noriega and the Sandinista wars. And, you know, so I was flanked on all sides, Panama, Nicaragua. Everybody was in a post-war disaster space. Mm. And I went down there as, like, you know, a blue-eyed girl, 19, 20 years old, by myself. And I only had $300 in my pocket. And I had no credit card.
How was your Spanish?
And nobody to call. So I'd studied Spanish in high school. And that means, if you've gone to public school yourself, you might know that means you don't speak Spanish at all.
Right. you could start a conversation and that's probably all, right?
No, I also had the worst classroom name. My name was Esperanza. and then my name also doesn't translate well into Spanish. So as I was introducing myself as Heather, it sounds a lot like a curse word, or, you know, or it also means to smell bad.
Awesome.
I go by the name Eva. And then, so I had a fake name already. So it's like witness protection right now. I'm really on an adventure. I'm living with a fake name, no money in my pocket and no plans. Yeah. But it was wild. And I just have to say, like, you and I were talking earlier about how we grow firefighters in these 30-year careers. And I look a lot at the human experience, about rites of passage and about how people grow into from childhood into adulthood. And there is a lot of documented evidence about how men go through rites of passage. I think the Marine Corps is a great way to go through a rite of passage from childhood into manhood.
Yes.
And there are a lot of cultures around the world who practice rituals to make sure you know that you're a man now.
Yes.
But there's not a lot of stuff for women, a lot of rites of passage for women. But boy, howdy, I'll tell you, I think that that year of my life, it's like dog years. It was only 13 months of my life that I was on the road, but I traveled 7 countries. I had to work the whole way. My Spanish became absolutely fluent because I was speaking street Spanish, and it's survival, right? Like all your mechanisms will turn on when you need them.
Yeah.
But I really feel like I came back, and I was only 21, but I came back as a woman. And so it's kind of that's part of maybe the journey that gave me the courage to even come into a job like this, which is, you know, hard and sometimes unwelcoming. But right. I was like, oh no, it's cool. Don't worry. I know who I am. I'll be good. Don't worry about me. You know?
No, that's awesome. Is there something that, during those 13 months, can you point to a breakover point where you went from kind of awkward and uncomfortable to, okay, I got this?
Oh yeah. It was in the third week when I got in the same week when I got bit by a monkey and stung by a baby manta ray in the same trip. And I was in Nicaragua and there was no medical treatment. So they took me to a dentist who put iodine on my wounds. And that's when I was like, oh, I'm really in this now. Like I could die. And then, you know, there were roadblocks along the way, cars overturned, there were riots and everybody was armed. Like there were just machine guns everywhere. And that's when I went like, but I was on fire, man. Life is, I mean, when you're traveling, and this is what I learned, is you expand those boundaries of fear. I made choices that I would never allow my children to make. I have two little daughters, they're 8 and 11. I will never let them do the things that I did, you know, but.
Well, okay. So that brings up a really interesting question. Is that okay?
Oh, which part? Is it okay to limit them? Oh yeah, but this is what I'm doing for them. I'm giving them survival skills, tools, and street smarts from the earliest ages because they've got two parents who are firefighters and we tell them the truth about kind of everything.
Yeah.
We speak very openly about really everything that goes on. And our family has really clear communication. No questions are off the table. And so what I'm doing for my kids is they'll just make better decisions than I did. I mean, potentially, or they'll be better equipped if they do.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the... that's what's important. We don't want to limit their exposure and experience. No. But it's really scary to send a kid out in the world and say, hey, you're going to make some mistakes. You're going to take some lumps. And that's just what it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, all we can do as parents is give them the tools to be successful and hope that they wield those tools appropriately.
Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, raising up firefighters. You just alter potentially the way people perceive information, the way they think about things, and the way they treat themselves, and their boundaries, like the boundaries of things that they're willing to let happen to them. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. Hey, what's been true for me is that both I had this idea in my head about what my kids were going to be like, who they were, what the sports they were going to play, et cetera, et cetera. And they were not those pre-programmed people. Right. They were pre-programmed with their own software and I had no input. It was almost like input in that.
It's funny to watch that, isn't it? Yeah.
Which is, I feel it's a blessing. Like I love it, but I was a little bit shocked by it.
My
like,
husband,
who are these people?
My husband, Steve, and I call our kids our weird little roommates. Because it's like there's these people that you think you live with and all of a sudden I'm like, what, you don't eat that anymore? Like this was only 3 weeks ago. Like you don't fit in these shoes. Like I just thought I knew this person. And you know, so it's like this funny little person that you live with that you actually have no control over what's going on in their heads.
Right.
It's very humbling to realize that because
you have
especially if you've had a hard childhood or a rough life, you know, a lot of us really we endeavor to give that improved condition to our children. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we have a script and they don't follow the script.
No, and then we get mad.
Yeah.
Right? So this goes back to what we were talking about before I hit record.
Yeah, which is parenting and fire service, right?
Well, 100%. It's the lifetime employment model.
It is. Yeah.
And I'll just sort of walk back on this. So in an episode I did with Kelvin Barty, he talks about the lifetime employment model. And he just basically says, hey, we hire firefighters for life, 25 to 30 years. And so Heather and I, you know, the question I brought to you was, well, what is that? And what do we do with that?
Yeah.
And how do we allow firefighters who we hire when they're young and some not so much, but, you know, most young, and then they go through these life changes that shape and to redirect them oftentimes?
Well, you and I have already identified that we have some sort of a squirrel condition here. So I'm going to go back to a question you asked me a few minutes ago.
No, go ahead.
And have I always been a writer and how did I write the history book? That, I'm going to answer your question by saying that journey to Central America led me into studying anthropology. And I went to UC Berkeley. So I had been studying photography and anthropology at Cal with the interest of being like a National Geographic kind of photographer, right? And that led me down a long life of service jobs because you don't get a job after graduating with an anthropology bachelor's degree, right? And that's what brought me to the fire service. But that lens that I learned there, anthropology was about like the study of the human experience, and the travel made me realize how many things we all have in common, no matter what part of the planet we're living on. I say this to say that the fire service and that rites of passage model, when you talk about a 30-year fire service career, which is, you know, it's our traditional model that you make your full retirement at 30 years, the military will call a full service career 20 years, right?
Right. Yeah.
But this means you are getting people at various points in their life. I came in with already like a ton of a very, very random, very hardcore and a very mixed bag of experience at age 32 into the fire service. But we're also picking up people who are 21, 22, and they've never bought their own toilet paper, right? We have folks that are in their late 20s still living in with their parents. We've had people have their moms drop off their lunch at Academy. You know, Bobby forgot his lunch and we're like, oh, Bobby.
That's awesome.
This is awesome. Yeah, this is going to be awesome for like a whole few weeks.
Tell me you changed the name. Was it really Bobby?
It was not Bobby.
change the name to protect the naive and innocent. Yeah.
Oh, man. But rites of passage and the passages we all go through in life, whether that's like, that's our bravery and our naivete, like I'm saying, I went through with the decisions I made as a young person. You take, that was my thinker at age 20, 21. It was kind of self-destructive and very crazy, but really hungry for experience. I see this in the young firefighters that we hire, right? We get people that are like, I'm going in, boss. And you're like, no, you're not. Because I want you to come home at the end of the day.
Right.
But we really, and Frank Lieb just did a great thing about this with New York Fire, about talking about how the young firefighters will run through a wall for you.
Yes.
You know, and then the more you promote and the more you age in the job, you're doing the full risk management of like, how can we find the door, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that's the natural mature progression.
Yeah.
Right. You are developing tactical and organizational maturity. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's the, you know, we talk about the blinders, right? The young, inexperienced person on the job has narrow vision. And as you mature and grow, your vision opens and you see more, you take more in, even without even realizing you're doing it, you're pulling in more information because you have more understanding, more experience, et cetera, that you've gleaned from the organization, that you've gleaned from your studies, et cetera.
Right.
And so, you know, that's exactly what we're talking about, is that growth.
Yeah. So in anthropology, there's a guy named Joseph Campbell, and mm-hmm. he talks about the hero's journey.
Yes.
And he uses Luke Skywalker. If you've ever read this, it's truly fascinating. But Luke Skywalker as the Star Wars model, he kind of says that in the Hero with a Thousand Faces title is in reference to him studying world culture and saying that we always have this vision of a person from humble beginnings, and then they're met with a challenge, and then a mentor comes to them and offers them a challenge to change their life. They enter into the battlefield, which is usually represented as an underworld. Mm-hmm. And so they go into the cave. This is where they're stripped of their identity, their heads are shaved, their clothes are changed. And this is the enculturation process that we use in the fire service as well.
Yes.
But you go in, you enter into this battle, which in our case might be our fire academy and our probationary process. And then when we emerge out on the other side of that, we're reborn as a new person. And this is Luke Skywalker's journey, but it's the parable that Americans can recognize. But that story exists in like 5,000 years of human history.
Yes.
Something very similar about a warrior being met with a challenge, having a moment of almost failure, almost collapse, coming out of it and being reborn as a new person. The U.S. Marine Corps is one of the best places in the world to successfully go through this process of removing your identity, re-sculpting you, and then producing you on the other side as an end product. That's a new thing, right?
I would like you and everybody listening to know that I am suppressing an oorah right
now. Oh my God, don't suppress. Why would you suppress? and so anyway, the fire service and that 30-year model. And dude, just forgive me for my circuitous.
It's all good.
I'm on a long labyrinth in this conversation.
I got you.
But you see what I'm saying? Like this is how I see it. Is we need to forgive people for when they're going through their processes, and whether that means that they're having their first love, or they're finally moving out of their mom's house at age 28, or they're having their first breakup, or they're experimenting with their mullet, or like, you know, right. You got to forgive people.
We make fun of these young firefighters who show up in their first house with, you know, the giant Overland 4Runner,
yeah.
or, you know, Toyota Tacoma, that's, you know, this $80,000 truck all kitted out.
Yeah.
Well, let's understand that young firefighter is seeing more money than they've ever seen in their entire life.
Yeah.
All of a sudden. So their impression, we used to make fun of young Marines who would go to the local car dealer and And next thing you know, they've got a, you know, a 30% loan on a heap of crap car. It's the same kind of idea. It's, there's this naivety, there's just a lack of education and experience. I remember one of my platoon sergeants, I was brand new, you know, Marine, and he's like, hey boys, here's the deal. If you put away $100 a month, just every month or every paycheck, you'll be rich, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, bro, I got a quarter and two nickels. Are you kidding? And I got to get 3 weeks to pay for it.
Right.
You know, are you kidding me?
Right.
How is this going to work out?
Right.
But wisdom. Right. But and for years, I have held on to that piece of knowledge. I can see his face to this day. And I am full of regret because I never did it because I felt I couldn't. The point being is we have to be you and I here. Right. We're the older generation.
We're the OGs. Whether we like it or not. I don't know, when you look around, suddenly you're the adult in the room. It's a very strange experience.
It is. Oh, my gosh. And so it's our responsibility to look at people and go, hey, they're young.
Yeah.
Oh, in life.
Yes.
And that's okay, because guess what? We were all there one time. So what do we need to do to pour into those people to get them to be successful? And we're going to go there. But hold on. Let me walk you back for a second. We never touched on. So you alluded to this adventure and this high risk bone that you have in your body.
Yeah.
And so how did you end up in the fire service? Like, what's the story? How did you get there?
Oh, I'd love to tell you the story, because it is part of the crazy. Like I said, so I graduated from UC Berkeley, which is, I'm the first in my family to go to college. It felt like just such a massive accomplishment. I paid my own way through school. I got all scholarships. And
nice.
Yeah. And so it was a big deal. And then I came out of it and I couldn't get jobs, you know. And you know what it was? It was the tech industry. I'm 50. And so I'm born in 1973. I hit college. I mean, obviously I did that traveling and I did tons of junior college. I transferred into Cal. But it was 97 through 99. And as you will recall, living in California, I was in like north of Silicon Valley. It was the tech era. It was the phase 1 .com boom was happening right then. I learned all that photography and all that film study that I did during college was all analog. I literally was learning how to do, you know, I was like
cutting tape.
Record, pause, play, report, pause, play, record, pause, play. And that's how I edited film. And the very next year, that entire laboratory at Berkeley went digital and the entire world went digital. And I was a broke ass kid that didn't have the money to go digital. So everything I learned, like I still have a darkroom in my garage. I know how to print film, but nobody cares.
Right, right.
So I found myself very unemployable. Yeah. So I kept, you know, making my way. Doing hustle. I'm a super hustler. But I was doing like, I was translating documentation at an auction for like Spanish speaking car buyers. I was catering in San Francisco, for like the rich and famous. And truly I was at the finest catering company on the West Coast. And we were serving President of the United States and Robin Williams and Sharon Stone and celebrities, right? Like, so I was having access to all these incredible people. But I also, one of my other side hustles, I was still doing photography at a jazz club, and I worked at the pub next door in Oakland. And one night, a union meeting happened from one of the local fire agencies, and they came in, and I was just talking relentless shit about them and their family members and their dogs, and we were just laughing so hard. And one of them turned to me and said, "You have a great sense of humor. You should be a firefighter. Do you play sports?" And they're sizing me up, and I was like, "Yeah, I play sports, right?" So that's how it happened. Is that a union meeting was happening in the back room of my pub, and I just got plucked, and it was like kind of a talent scout moment. What was really cool about that is the person who influenced me, they helped me get into school. And within 2 weeks, I was in EMT school. Then I went into fire science school right away. I had a professor who was like, "Hey, this job takes 2 to 7 years to get hired. Start applying now." So he taught me that very aggressive model of just being like, even if you don't feel like you're ready, you're going to get ready, but start the process now.
Right.
And he caught me in an economic window where it was 2005 or 2004. He taught me that. 2005, I got the job offer, started in 06. And then everybody I was in school with that didn't heed that advice ended up actually changing professions and maybe going single role medic or maybe going into law enforcement. But people I was in school with at that time, if we didn't catch that little window in the economy before things shifted in 2007, 2008, they they didn't get hired and fire. And so, it's, and now, you know, we're paying incentives for people to come work for us. So yeah, times have changed.
Well,
we lined up.
Timing is everything. And I'm excited to talk to you about that a little bit more, because we're going to get into that when we talk about the recruitment issues that we face.
Yeah.
Right? We'll get to that. But that's, that timing is critical for so many reasons, right? The window of time. And I feel like for you, you're like, hey, if I'd have missed that window at a certain point, you're like, well, I'm going to move on and
I would have
have kids and do the other things in life that are important. And that, and then now I'm getting to a point where I'm too old to go. And, you know, I've seen some folks who are in their 40s in the fire academy, and I'm like, whew.
Good for you.
Don't know I could do it, you know?
You're a badass. No way. I am so respectful of those people.
Yeah. It's impressive.
Yeah.
One, you're following your dreams and making a massive life pivot.
And the humility that it takes to be an adult learner and to step back into that subservient role and to go back through a rite of passage that you probably already passed through 20 years ago.
Right. Whew. Right.
Good for you. And I'm recruiting them too. Trust me. And you know what? We just talked about the 30-year career. I'm actually wondering, I would posit that that is going to change just because of .com and technology, because of the great resignation. I think we're seeing so many more people not staying in long-term marriages, not staying in one state or city for a long time. Everybody's moving. We're all moving. And I don't know if we're going to get 30-year firefighters anymore. I wonder if we're going to modularize our enrollments and our deployments. Are we going to say, I'm going to sign you for 10 years and with a signing bonus to continue? Are we going to break it into 5-year, 10-year spans? Because what if we get people when they're in their crazy, you know, lusty, athletic 20s, when they want to be your hardcore firefighters, and then they bail out and go on and do something safer? Because we are having a problem with retention.
So let me ask you that. I'm going to ask you the question. I want your perspective on this. What is it that is causing people to choose to leave? Because I will say, I've watched this in my previous organization that I just left from. There's a record high number of people, and I'm throwing up air quotes here, leaving the job early, right? Mm-hmm. 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, came, saw, did it, now I'm out.
And it's unheard of to us, right?
Yeah. Well, and so here's the two questions, I guess. I got more questions. What's the what is it that landed us in the 25 to 30 year career? Right? Why is that a thing? Okay. Right? And why would people leave it early? Like those of us who've been in it for the long haul, why do people leave early? Because, and I will say this, the Marine Corps model, the military model is, hey, there are some who come and do 4 years.
Yeah.
And then there are some who stay for the whole enchilada.
Yeah, that 20, right.
And it's a big dichotomy.
Yes.
But most people...
It's a different personality type too, I believe.
Right. So is that what's affecting us in the fire service?
Well... Gosh. Okay. So I'm going to answer
Let's
that.
Let's do it.
Yeah. I'm changing my position here. Okay. So I don't think I'm smart enough to answer the question about why do we have a 30-year career, because that's a piece of history. I don't know. I think it has something to do with how we've modeled out state retirements, pension plans.
I would submit to you that's exactly what it is. Now, that's me just hazarding.
Yeah, that's anecdotal.
Guess, but I think that's real.
I don't know, but I can tell you that physically it doesn't seem to be working very well, especially because we have a really high mortality rate after retirement. You know, we statistically as a profession, we die within 10 years of retirement. That's not good, especially because the whole goal is to get to a healthy, happy retirement. And we get divorced like in the final year and lose our assets. And then, you know, and then there's the whole crisis of what happens when you do leave and our identities have been all wrapped up in our careers. And then there's a malaise that happens to retired firefighters that they don't often have support and camaraderie and all the things that we became so accustomed to is like sitting around that dining table, man. It can be the most a dangerous place in the firehouse, and it can be the happiest place in your memories, right? I'm laughing at the coffee table is something like I just promoted into a division spot where I'm in a 40-hour week. I miss that time. It is valuable to my heart, like the stuff that goes down, the connections that are made, the things that people are worried about, like it's the barometer of the world, you know, and you have your firehouse lawyers and your your firehouse real estate agents and your firehouse financial specialists. Yeah, everybody's, yeah. You know, and they're all like, now we're on kale shakes and now we're paleos. I miss moving with those trends of being in the station. I'm gonna try to answer that question though. Like we talked about that military model, you can enlist in the military and stay for periods of time, blocks of time. The U.S. Fire Service isn't set up to support that, but I'm wondering if maybe it should be. I'm wondering if maybe we should find a way that we can recruit people that want to come in for the, you know, for the wild physicality of it. But what it takes for the physical body and the human spirit to endure a 30-year career, one of the things that's impacting our longevity, not just our retention, but our longevity, is obviously we have one of the highest cancer rates, some of the highest divorce rates. We have all kinds of psychic injury, you know, the behavioral health aspect of it. One of the factoids that I have heard is that an average human being experiences about 4 traumatic experiences in their lifetime. And we see on the average about 800, and that's the average. So that means some of you are seeing more than 800.
Like feels like that's 8,000.
Yeah,
feels bad to me.
Sort of feels like 8,000 sometimes.
Yeah.
And you know, and we drink and we compartmentalize and we do all kinds of things.
Yeah.
But one of the things that affects us the most in that 30-year retention problem is that lack of sleep, that chronic sleep disorder, and our inability to ever get into deep sleep or to ever process our dreams, that septic system of the soul, you know, we don't actually ever get a chance to really drop this stuff. So we're just containing it all. So that's there's a saturation point there that we have to acknowledge. And trying to do a 30-year career, it's daunting. And I'm seeing just even the OGs in my life are leaving at 22 or 25 years. They're like, I'm good. I'm done. I want to retire healthy. Now the goal is just to get out of there with your, you know, with your body parts intact and with your heart not broken, right? So when you talk about these young folks leaving early, man, they have so many options and there are so many ways to live this life with a shortcut. We're very much a comfort and convenience-based culture, right? We've become all about how can I be more comfortable, more shiny, more easy. We're not looking at that depth of service that Brunicini talked about. We're not talking about like Albert Schweitzer. He said, you know, I don't know what your destiny will be, but the only ones among you who will be truly happy are those who have sought and found how to serve. That calls to people, like those of us who have been called to the job because we're like, I literally know that I am the one to help you here. I can do this. Let me help. Mm-hmm. That's a certain personality type. Mm-hmm. Maybe people after 5 years discover they're not that person and they don't have that altruism or empathy. Maybe they find out they have so much altruism and empathy that it's too hard and it's hurting too much. I can't do this because this job hurts too much. Or it's affecting my family, my ability to do relationship. It's affecting my physical body. We're always trying to get professional athletes and college athletes and Olympians to come work for us. Those people who have dedicated themselves to their bodies as a temple, they struggle with the sleep disruption patterns. They struggle with the nutrition. They struggle with the toxic exposures. They're like, hey, my body's a temple. That's what, you know, I came here because this job is physical. But what you didn't know is it's dirty. The job's dirty. It's like we're janitors, you know, street janitors, and you're going to get it on you. You're going to get human waste on
excrement.
You. You're going to have other people's secretions on your shirt. And, you know, I'm serious, man, you got to think about it. And it's so funny because we sell the glamour side, but we don't honestly sell like, hey, you're going to have to put grandma's pants back on before we put her on the gurney in the bathroom. And you're going to have to clean her bottom. And that is a very, very big step from the very sexy and often macho imagery that we sell, the bravado that we sell. But, you know, one of the things I recognize about the fire service, we're keepers of the public trust. And I do believe we need to maintain that image of like, imperviousness. We're untouchable. Like you can't break us. The problem is, you know, that we're all breaking. Right? But somebody needs to be able to look to someone in society and say, I trust you to help me right now. I trust you to take my child from my arms. I trust you to go in and get my dog from the house while it's burning. I'm trusting you to come into my home in the middle of the night. I'm here alone, and I'm going to let three big men with, you know, suitcases walk into my door, which I left propped open because I trust the fire service. Man, that is a treasure beyond belief in the human experience, to have reached this level where we can be, where we have that integrity and that esteem in culture. You have to be the kind of person that wants to be that. And if you find that it's not working for you, there's probably more to those layers. But the retention issue, I think, comes down to people in all aspects of their life. We're always seeking the next thing. And we have so many options now in this global culture. You can go wherever you want. You can go get a new girlfriend. You can order people on Amazon at this point. And you can get weed delivered to your house. My God, like, what world is this, right? Like, everything is a convenience.
Yeah. Well, it makes me wonder, though. We talk about the idea of the cultural shift to ease and comfort and access. Mm-hmm. And so I have sat around the kitchen table and had the conversation where everyone was like, well, this new generation. And I'm wondering, it's not the generation of people necessarily, it's the paradigm shift in our culture. That's what I hear you saying.
It's all of us. I mean, dude, you've checked your phone we both checked our phones while we've been talking. All of us have changed our behaviors. Mm-hmm. All of us. Technology has changed us. We are in the period of growth and most exponential change that we've ever seen in human history, mm-hmm. right? And like I say, I went to college in 99. A year later, my shit was obsolete, mm-hmm. right? That's painful, but that's how fast it is for all of us. That's how our elders feel. Right. The older people in our fire service are like, yeah. You don't know what I went through to get here, and now you got a pay incentive or a bonus to sign on, right. And it creates a little cultural and like a generational
separation.
A rift. That's a great mm-hmm. word. We don't understand each other. But I think about that word entitlement. We use that a lot for the young generation. I feel quite entitled in my own life at age 50. I'm an old person, you know, in most people's eyes. But I have a little sense of entitlement too. That it's come with like the way that I've earned things and the way I've raised and where I live. But I think entitlement for young people. I was wondering about this with my own children, especially the young recruits that we're pulling in. Have you ever considered that when we were young, and I know you went into the Marine Corps, my dad was a drill instructor, I grew up in a military household. I remember being told, when I want you to have an opinion, I'll give you one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, stop crying or I'll give you something to cry about. Yeah. I remember being like, as a kid, very separated from adults and very much like there was a kid's table and an adult table.
100%.
Go in the other room, make yourself scarce. You know, I remember in the like 70s, 80s, this was how life was. And that's very normalizing for us.
Yeah.
And now people are like, their children are always with them. Their children are like, what would you like to eat? What should we have for dinner? Which donut do you choose? And I do it to my own kids. I'm not just, this is not a blanket judgment. It's, I think, a sociological phenomenon we're all experiencing with the helicoptering and the way that we guard our kids because we're scared for them. We want to protect them. And we save up for their college. So we will suffer to make sure that they can go and get drunk on campus, you know, and blow their freshman year, you know. But I think that shift, it all has to do, that sense of entitlement is now like social media, for example. You know, you can be like 14 years old and have 2 million people watching what you're doing and approving of you. That is like, you've been given the right to have an opinion at a very young age.
Okay, so.
Go ahead.
No, that's, you're touching on something that's really important, which is this idea that the world that we live in, the water we're swimming in, affects us, right? And it affects the fire service in a way that I think we're not allowing space for. We're just sitting, pounding our fists on the kitchen table going, why is it changing? Right? Because, and I'll say this, and I've said it 1,000 times, right? We hate change and we hate the way it is, right? But so it begs the question, what do we do with that information, mm-hmm. right? Because we have to shift something. We can't, I just got off the phone with a friend of mine who works for the city of Phoenix, right? My alma mater. They are putting on a testing process and they had 500 people put in.
I know, right. And they need to hire 80 or 150 or something.
And this is an organization that is historically had 3,000 people put in.
Yeah.
So with that shift, mm-hmm. right? Holy mackerel, what do we do with that, right? We need hundreds of people.
Yeah.
We're not getting the depth of pool.
No.
So our candidate pool's problematic because mm-hmm. we're not going to get the best of the best of the best because they're not applying.
Mm-hmm.
Is this is this a marketing problem? You talked about marketing a minute ago, and you said we put out these high gloss, shiny, you know, videos, you know, kick doors and save lives, rip people from the clutches of death. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a rad part of the job.
Is that real? Because 80%+ of the job is EMS. Which, boo. How do you sell that?
I don't know, man. Right. I'm a medical services chief, and it is hard to sell. It's a tough sale.
So is it any wonder that we recruit people who then go, meh, it's not what I thought it was.
Yep. That is the exit interview right there. It's not what I thought it was.
Yeah.
So, how are we telling them? So your recruitment problems in Phoenix are the same as they are in New York, LA, Chicago, Seattle.
Yeah.
So this paper, do you want to hear about this paper I wrote?
Yeah, so let's dive into that
Let me tell you about that, because I feel like it ties into what we're 100% saying here. So I went to Naval Postgraduate School. And that presentation, I was able to give that at the EFO symposium last year. I have not attended the National Fire Academy, just to be clear about that.
You were just a guest speaker.
I was a guest speaker. That's right. Yeah. So that's why it was the EFO paper. But I wrote it at a Naval Postgraduate School as my master's thesis. And so from my own lived experience as a woman in the fire service and from that anthropological background and the historical background that I have, I was like, when we talk about retention problems or diversification problems with the fire service and organizational leadership, it's really hard to start even finding out how many women there are in the United States fire service. So that question alone led me down the path. I was in the Los Angeles Fire Department Leadership Academy maybe 5, 7, 6 years ago, and Chief Terrazas presented. And he was the chief at the time, previous to Crowley. And Terrazas asked me to his office, and he said, I'd like to speak to you about something. And I had this amazing 25-minute conversation with Chief Terrazas. But what he asked me is about that he had just been pressured by his city manager to try to get the recruitment up to at least 6.5% women in his next academy. And he said, how do I do it? And I was like, why are you, first of all, respectfully, sir, why are you asking me?
What do I know? You know?
What do I know? the next question was, why 6.5%? How arbitrary is that number? That struck me as very like awkward. Like, why did, that sounds like a quota. What are we doing? And so I had to talk to him about this very same thing. We have a historically low candidate pool.
Are you talking about Alameda, or you mean?
I was in Los Angeles at the time, but okay. I mean, we in the United States Fire Service, when we're trying to recruit women firefighters, there is a historically low candidate pool.
Yes.
But that conversation with Chief Terrazas, and then my entry into Naval Postgraduate School led me down this 3-year research process of trying to uncover the issues with recruitment and retention of women firefighters. So, the very first thing I recognize is the lack of data, is that we don't actually know. And so I started checking out the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the NFPA and the USFA, and all the numbers are different. And what I realized is the numbers may seem very skewed. Like you might seem, well, how come we only have 4% when, Seattle's got 26%? I'm like, well, that's a great question. Well, guess what? When you start to distill down the numbers and actually identify how that statistic is being built. Mm-hmm. The statistic can be built by saying that we've actually identified all the female employees, like everyone who is in arson and prevention and single role
the
EMS.
The allied professionals, yes. Not necessarily fire service.
Yes, and the single role EMS person and the clinical educator and all those people. And even if they're uniformed, you know, they're not necessarily sworn. Yeah, and the difference is because the structure of the fire service is that structural firefighting has been truly the stronghold. It is the most imbalanced gender imbalanced profession in America. And that's interesting, right? So there's more like, deep sea welders and ice road truckers, and there's more women doing everything else than in other professions, even hardcore industry, than there is in the fire service. So fire service sits at 4.4% women at this time. So what I looked at was how long has that been going on and maybe why? So it was at the time of my birth, 1973, it would have been illegal for me to be a firefighter. It was not legal in the United States, and it was attached to the Civil Rights Act until 1974 that women were allowed into the U.S. Fire Service. And obviously, as you know, historically, it didn't necessarily go very well, that initial integration.
Right.
So that number is really not gone beyond 4% over the course of 49 years.
Right.
Which is fascinating because that's not the narrative we tell. We see news headlines like more women being hired or things are changing or girl power.
Right.
And it's like, well, okay, so I'm going to take all the emotion out of this or what I wish was or how I feel about it. And I'm not going to write an editorial, but I'm going to write a research paper that tells things. I use a slide in my presentation by Confucius that says the beginning of wisdom is to call things by their right name.
I love that.
Yeah, because you can't start writing the equation until you know what the problem is, right?
Yep.
So I had to identify where the false narratives were coming from, and then just try to distill down what the actual issues were. So with this, I found over 49 years, never really been more than 4% women, despite consent decrees, affirmative action, quota processes, pressure from your city managers, you know, whatever it is. And so what's the reason for that? So I took the obstacle courses, and I divided it into four parts. And I basically identified the four gates of limitations for women. The first is the physicality gate.
I wanted to wow you because I was going to drop the four gates on you because I read your presentation.
Did you?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. But now you just blew that out of the
What are you, like the kind of person who does research?
I tried.
Have a conversation?
I tried to do a little bit.
Dang!
Yeah. So the
that's
four gates.
That's why you're the chief.
I'm just an IC man. Let's not overblow this.
You saw the four gates. It makes sense, right?
Well, no. So when you talk about the four gates, I was going to pull us to there because those are, to me, really important social pillars that we need to navigate. And everybody does. And we all have to be mindful of that. So let's talk about them.
Hey, and truthfully, all four of those gates also are true for men, but in just different proportions, mm-hmm. right? They're absolutely gender neutral, but these were the experiences that I completely distilled down and recognized from the data and research that I gathered that these are the reasons that people are either unsuccessful or they leave early. So in recruitment especially, my posit, I will tell you, my conclusion of this thesis was we need to stop focusing on recruitment and focus on retention. And now I'll tell you why that is. So the four gates are set up as first the physicality gate, and this would be obvious to anyone listening, right?
Yeah.
You have to be strong enough to be a firefighter.
Right.
The weight of water has not changed. Our gear is heavy.
You mean to tell me the laws of physics apply here?
Yeah, but don't tell anyone at the dinner table that because we also have firehouse physicists. and it doesn't matter whether you're throwing aluminum or wood ladders. Our American population has higher BMI than they've ever had before. Our patients are heavier.
Yeah.
You know, our gear, and we have more and more safety equipment that we carry with us. So we're doubling our body weight every time we get geared up. And then you want to send us up a flight of stairs, right? So you have to have a certain amount of physical grit to do this job.
So let me go back just a smidge.
Go ahead.
Are these four gates things that you would identify as things that prevent women from coming on the job, or are they wickets that prevent people from staying on the job?
So,
or both?
So the paper is about recruitment and retention, and the four gates, actually, literally, I called them gates because you have to be able to pass through that gate.
Yeah.
And if you can't pass through that gate, you will fail.
Okay.
And you'll either not be you will not enter in,
or you won't,
or you'll not be able to stay. And your physicality, if you look at it that way, your physicality will prevent you from passing our entry level exams. They'll prevent you from your CPAT, they will prevent you from succeeding at the tower. And your long-term physicality will prevent you from being able to do the job and may cause you to leave early, if you follow me.
Yes, I am. I'm tracking. I love it. Is some of this prevent people from even entertaining the fire service?
Yeah, for sure. And so, and let me say that when I talk about that historically small data candidate pool, that's a very small group. So first you have to take the women who want to do the job.
Yeah.
And of those women, you have to find the women who can do the job.
Yeah.
And that's where the quotas, like Chief Terrasas was facing, are very dangerous. Because if I do not have the players who are game ready, don't make me pick a player, right?
Right.
And what's happening is there's a political influence on the fire service for leaders to say, you're not doing enough to recruit women. And there's a lot of finger pointing and browbeating. But what needs to happen is people need to understand this is the pool that's available. There's things you can do to increase the number of players that come to your candidate pool.
Yeah.
You can do lots of stuff in advance to recruit and garner and gather people. But if I look at data of 49 years and say there's never been more than 4% women in the fire service, that tells me that there's always going to be a very small group of Americans who show up to come to this job, right? That's just, it's just the facts. Like this is, it's not that we're all doing it wrong. If we call things by their right name, we have to recognize there's going to be a small part of society that wants to participate in this. Mm-hmm. And of them, we have to put them through trials to prove that they're worthy of it, right? And so this is where our jobs come in as fire service leaders, is not only trying to find those people, but then, you know, making sure we grow the people that can do it. So the physicality gate is number one.
Yeah.
I compared that to military and law enforcement. And again, an argument from your politician might be, how come fire service only has 4%? Because this is an old boys club and you guys are a frat house and you guys just don't want women. And then there's people with their hands up going, I'd hire women if they were here. You know, I talked to lots of fire chiefs and be like, I'd love to have more women on my crew.
Yeah.
Can't find them.
Right.
So
and then, I throw a hook in the water
and
nobody shows up. Right.
Yeah. What are you going to do about that? Yeah.
Is it not the right bait?
Well,
to use my fish metaphor.
And there's lots of reasons that I'll get to in the next gate
about
why women may be deterred from even investigating the fire service.
Yeah.
But if you compare fire service at 4% female membership to law enforcement and to military, mm-hmm. I can't get the stats exactly right in my mind, but at this time, the most recent data for law enforcement's about 17% and military is about 27%. Why so many more women in those professions? I broke that down to say that there are equalizers in those professions. You can take a different tract when you enter the military. You have to get through a basic boot camp, but you can go off and be a clerk or a dietitian. You can go do different things in the military that are not just combat. And then in law enforcement, it's the same way. You get through your basic, and then you can take a tract, and then you've also got weapons and a car, and you've got all these things that can equalize your force and strength.
Right.
So you could maybe be a smaller female police officer,
right?
But you're carrying a weapon, you know, and you're still lethal, and I'm sure that you're trained in hand-to-hand combat, but you're also not having to carry a 300-pound dude on your back down a ladder. It's a different kind of strength.
Yes.
So firefighters, because of our gender-neutral physical requirements, there are very few women that can fulfill the same physical exam that a man has to fulfill for basic quals.
Right.
So how I quantified that was I took special ops. So both the SWAT team and the special ops teams for the military, like the Green Beret and the SEALs and the Army Rangers, those are gender-neutral physical exams. They don't have any age variation, because now, you know, the army has changed their regulations. So what you have to bench press is different than what I have to bench press as a 50-year-old female. Like you would have a different standard, and a 25-year-old person would have a different standard than you.
Right.
So the military has made those adaptations to be able to continue, keeping our armed forces staffed.
Yes.
Right? And I support
that. Well, I would say recruitment and retention for the armed forces has been a problem as well.
No, man. Nobody wants to do hard work.
Yeah.
Blue-collar jobs are not sexy anymore. It's just the facts.
Right.
So there we go. So when you look at SWAT and you look at special ops, it goes down to 0.5% for SWAT. There's only 0.5% women in SWAT teams in America, and then there's only 2% women in special ops. So take that physicality gate. As soon as you enter into that place where there's a gender-neutral physical exam, which you cannot, I don't imagine a way that you can veer away from that. Firefighters need to do all the work. They need to be able to do all the work because we're the utility tools, because we're the multi-use servants. You have to be able to pick up the patients. You have to be able to throw the ladder. You have to be able to get the hose line. You have to make the attachment. You got to be able to drive the rigs.
We have pitched and have stood up an all hazards model.
Yeah.
Which requires us to be able to do all the things.
Yes. Which is where our superhero egos are so stimulated. Yes. Mm. Because it is a great, that's where the capes come in. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean,
I picked mine up at the cleaners this morning.
No, I know. And I'm not, I mean, obviously like we're grown people, but it's, you know, man, the pride I feel in being a firefighter, it separates me from other people, honestly, because I'll be like, man, you don't know what I do. Right? Yeah. I got some swag around it, and it's narcissistic, and I know that, but we need a certain level of overconfidence to even get into this job, right? We attract these like alpha type personalities, and then we throw them all into a station for 48 hours and hope for the best. It's like, what'd you think was going to happen? Of course there's infighting. Of course we're creating drama, a total drama island for ourselves. But yeah, so the physicality gate, number one.
Boom.
Number two, sociocultural gate. And that has to do, in the thesis, I dive deeply into the work-home balance and challenge, the who the woman is in the home and then who the woman is in the workplace. There is a disparity there. I don't go into that when I present it to the masses, but it's very interesting to read about the inner circle of the life of a female and then how she has to present herself in social group. That I did a little bit more anthropology in the paper with that.
Yeah.
But the sociocultural gate in the firehouse is what I like to talk about. Mm-hmm. And that is, the Canadian Fire Service calls it othering, when a person is isolated, or outgrouped. Women already come in like looking different and identifying differently. And then now I have to also confront all the expectations and the baggage that you carry about who you think I am. I will be challenged by not only my citizens, like old ladies and kids are like, you can't be a firefighter. You're too pretty, you know? And,
They let women drive fire trucks.
Thank you. And what do you do for the fire department? Just a secretary. And then I just remember being on the roof of a house where a World War II veteran had busted his ankle. And I climbed to the top of that ladder. And he's like, oh, hell no, I am not getting rescued by a woman today.
Good.
And his neighbor.
Get your own ass off this roof.
His neighbor was out there filming it. And he goes, oh, this is going to be great, Jerry.
That's hilarious.
I had to carry that gentleman down the stairs. And it was humbling for both of us, I'm sure. But no, I mean, I'm used to it. And it's funny to me, which is why grit and sense of humor are the only way that you can survive this job, right? Like the people that are actually happy in this profession are usually we usually have pretty dark senses of humor. So the sociocultural gate has to do with the way that people relate in the firehouse.
Yeah.
And that's a real breaking point. You know, the outgrouping definitely leads to the retention problem. It deters people during the recruitment process and it leads to early demise in the retention process.
Yeah.
I put this heavily on leadership because if you're a strong company officer, if you're a conscientious battalion chief, and if you're just not a complete jerk, you should really be making sure that the people in your house are getting along. Like you should not be supporting a dysfunctional family.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And the fraternal model doesn't really have a room for sisters in the name.
Yeah. So. It's interesting, I've heard people refer back to this idea. We call our organizations a family, right? Mm-hmm. The fire service family. Mm-hmm. And I've had some folks who are a little frustrated. Go, hey, this is not a family. Mm-hmm. Like we don't treat each other with love and courtesy and respect.
Yeah.
And they're pointing to the organization who is doing things, instilling policies, et cetera, that may not be family oriented.
Right.
Right. Like, hey, we're going to mandatory you to work.
Yeah.
What? How's that?
How is this good for my family?
Right. I signed up for overtime and then you're mandatory me on top of that.
Like
these are dysfunctions that are organizational structural issues that are crippling the family component. And then we go to the firehouse and get othered, right. And get made to feel less than because we're a little bit different or we're not a hunter or we're not a football fanatic or whatever the social piece is, right? We're quirky or whatever.
Yeah. So you might be interested that like Netflix, I think, is one of the companies that probably in business management has modeled this, but they don't talk about family. They never refer to workplace as family. They talk about team. Yeah. And I referred to this in my presentation yesterday and we had a great conversation afterwards about it at the Women's Symposium. But the idea of... you know, of being welcomed into the family. It's like, hey, how can you have a family without a mama? You know, how come I'm not allowed to be here? Like, I'm a mama, I'm a sister, I'm a daughter.
Right.
How come you don't got room for me at your table? Right. You know, I make good biscuits.
And I'm going to add a layer of complexity to that, right? We have siblings in this business who don't identify as male or female.
Right.
How do we bring them into the family when we don't have space for our sisters even?
Yeah. And I think every industry is dealing with that, like that phenomenon of not wanting to hurt people's feelings. But then when you tell people to identify their pronouns, they go per squeak. They just lose their biscuits. Like, I can't believe we're talking about this.
It's a tough pivot in the business that we're dealing with, right? Because we are so closely knitted together. We live together. We spend all this time together. Mm-hmm. And so I guess where I go is, hey, we are a family, but there's going to be some dysfunction, but if we truly give a crap, we got to take care of it.
Yeah. So if you imagine this model, instead of looking at the family model, if you look at it as a team instead, think, what does a team do? A team has a primary objective, and that is to win and be victorious. We have a mission.
Yeah.
We have a common mission. And then we train for our success. Mm-hmm. And we bring up the people who need more help. And we advance and amplify the voices of people who are natural leaders. This is what a team does. And so the fire service family, I like that because it feels good and we eat together and we hug. But I like the team model much more when it comes to the leadership management model, because I like I like to know that everybody knows they have a responsibility. Also, when we talk about women in the fire service, one of the messages I put forward is keep your standards at varsity level. This is a varsity level sport.
Period.
If you're not ready to be here, please continue training and come back next year.
Yeah.
Right? But I don't give up. I'm not telling you to go away. But if you're not cut for it, like, please, leaders, stop choosing people who are not suited because of their last names or because of the color of their skin or because of their body parts.
Right.
Choose the people, like, keep this in the paramilitary, in respect for the military model, keep it a meritocracy. Keep it to the level of people who have educated themselves and physically prepared themselves enough to come and do battle. And because I need you immediately to be ready. I'm going to give you between 12 weeks for a lateral academy, 20 weeks for a recruit academy, and I am going to trust you with people's lives in just a few minutes. So I need you to be the right person for the job. And I think people's egos need to get out of their own ways because they feel like, I have the heart of a lion. I'm going to go do this. I think I can do this. And it's like, I'm glad you and your mom think that you can do this, but you need to perform now.
Right.
And when we talk about that hero's journey and you go into the underworld and you pass through, it's our job on the leadership side to make sure that that inculturation, once they come out as the new person, the journey's truly just begun right there. And that's where we drop people off and forget about them.
Right.
We throw them into the firehouse and we say, hope for the best. And you don't know what captain they're going to get. And you don't know what crap they're going to go through.
Right.
And we don't continue mentoring. We just move on to the next recruit academy because we're trying to produce more people. So...
Yeah.
That sociocultural gate, huge breaking point. Women deal with harassment, discrimination, sexual abuse in the fire station, all kinds of hazing and pranking, being zip-tied in their sleep. I mean, there's underwear being frozen and hung up on the flagpole, dating other firefighters and having those sex videos and sex messages getting sent out to the entire district. There's lots of reasons if you're like a young woman coming in or a young person at all coming into the fire service, I'm going to take a look at this and you go, dang, look at their cancer rates. Look at their suicide rates. Look how many lawsuits they have against each other. This isn't what I thought it was. So some people self-eliminate before they get here. Some people spend a few years in and go, dang, I can't survive this. And then, so the sociocultural gate is massive, and it's true for the men and the women. I think it answers your questions about why we're seeing five years of, unheard of. People are leaving before they even get vested in PERS in my state. They're like, I'm done. I'm out. I got to go. I'm like, what? What are you going to do? Whatever I want.
Yeah.
And the people we're trying to recruit, when it comes to women especially, we're looking for smart, tough, and nice. You know, we're looking for intelligence and physical superiority. So we go try to poach them from college campuses, try to get college athletes. And guess what? A woman who has like a degree and was like a college basketball player has a lot of job opportunities that don't involve sleeplessness, being socially ostracized. These are people who have been accustomed in their lives to also already being very well-loved and popular, right? And now you're going to put them in a place where they're going to be the wrong way trout.
Yeah.
And they're going to have to suffer their whole lives just to be liked, you know? And that's exhausting. So I think it's emotionally exhausting and people see they have other choices.
Yeah.
And I think that globalization of information, I think technology, I think the ways that we can live life more easily without ever skinning our knuckles, maybe we're forgetting how good it feels to do hard work, how good it feels when you fix your engine yourself, or how awesome it is to run a chainsaw or put out a fire or save a person's life and be all sweaty and hot and scared and look at your buddy in their eyes and just be like, oh my God, do you believe that just happened? And we do that. And that's why firefighters have this crazy bond. It's like, we know, I know what's behind your eyes, you know, not exactly, but I relate to you in a way I don't relate to the other portions of the human population.
Right.
So anyway, that's a sociocultural gate. The next gate I had to acknowledge is parenting and maternity. Mm-hmm. For women specifically, recent studies through FEMA and University of Arizona are showing that we have a 27% miscarriage rate It's affecting our reproductive capabilities. Our ability to breastfeed is often disrupted by, as soon as you go back online, that being in the firehouse and being under that state of like the sympathetic nervous system where you're just all fired up and cramped up, your cortisol increases, your adrenaline increases, your breast milk supply will disappear, right? Or you're exposing your body to toxins that are going to now transfer to the baby.
That was there's a great research project that Dawn Bolstead started. She had a firefighter come to her. She's an industrial hygienist.
Okay.
She had a firefighter come to her and say, "Hey, I'm back to work. I just had a fire. I'm breastfeeding my child. How soon is it okay?" And Dawn was like, "Oh my God.
Nobody knows the answer to this question.
How soon? Let's look into it."
Yeah.
And so that firefighter, bless her heart, she started pumping and they would mm-hmm. test her milk and they did. She was just committed to this. Mm-hmm. That project has gone on in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. But they demonstrated that you have at least 3 days of toxins. And Dawn's like, "Hey, we all need to know this because you male firefighters have the same problem."
Yes.
Those toxins are still in you for 3 days. And anecdotally, we all know that, right? 2 days after the fire, you take a shower and you're like, "I still smell like smoke."
You go do hot yoga and you have black footprints on your white towel. You're like, "Wait a minute, I
showered." Where'd that come from?
Yeah, that's in your cells.
Exactly.
We always say in holistic medicine, they say your issues are in your tissues.
Yes, there it is.
But you can tell just from that, like your body is storing that nasty and it's in you.
Yeah.
And now we're dealing with all the PFAS and all the rest of that stuff.
Right.
So that's, again, like I say, all these gates apply to all of us. And that's a great point that you make. And the reproductive issues are also affecting men and their fertility and their sperm count. And so there's testicular cancer very high in men, ovarian cancer very high in women. Our reproductive organs are the fragile points in our body, and they tend to be the collection points for carcinogens. So the sleeplessness is its own carcinogen. The toxic exposures are a carcinogen. And then oftentimes the way we treat each other in the firehouse is not good for our blood pressure and our hearts, right? So there's lots
of things. Toxic on a whole new level.
I know, we're kind of our own little toxic waste dump in our own right. But that's not the image we sell, right? We sell the sexy pretty image and the shiny badges and we look so good, but you know what the truth is, it's hard, dirty, gnarly work, and it takes a different kind of tenacity. So for parenting, those obstacles for women, of course, women, I had to address this because women are the baby makers. Even if a firefighter's not going to become a parent or a mother, it's important to acknowledge that this issue has not been addressed because women have low representation on their unions. And their issues never really make it to the front page because they're such a super minority. There's usually every agency only has like one or two women. 50% of American fire departments don't have any women. So there you go. It's a non-issue. And then of those 50%, as I said, you know, you have 0.5% females in New York Fire. You know, Seattle's coming in at 7. San Francisco's at 9. Those are the highest in the country. And Miami-Dade's got 11%, highest percentage of women. But that's still not a very loud voice when it comes to legislation and policy change, right? So it takes, that's one of the reasons that it may be important to see the voices of women, even if you have a small minority of women, to amplify their voices within your agency, to get them involved in the committees, the unions, the leadership roles, because they're going to be that one voice that does acknowledge, "Hey, I know that this doesn't affect everybody here, but it does affect that one person. And that person has like legal rights to a safe and sound professional workspace, you know?"
Right.
So, we addressed, maternity leave issues. 2/3 of American fire service agencies don't have a policy at all for maternity leave. They freak out when somebody gets pregnant. It's not a medical emergency, by the way, it'll be okay. And then they have, you know, definitely no space for breastfeeding. And then there's no real plan for the postnatal experience. So after the baby's born, you know, you'll get your FMLA time, federally mandated FMLA time.
Right.
But what that means is all you have is a 12-week umbrella where you're allowed to take your own leave. So it's 12 weeks where you're allowed to use all your vacation, all your sick leave.
Right.
And then when the baby's born, God forbid you or the baby get sick, or you have, you know, kind of, you know, you need baby bonding time, or, you know, you're trying to breastfeed, which is not as easy as they make it look on TV. And it's, you know, it's this very daunting time where if we don't have a system in place, it's not time, it's not, to build the ship while you're sailing it, whatever.
Right, right.
It's the plane while you're flying it. Yeah. Trying to figure that out while your woman is 6 months pregnant.
Right.
It's got to get vetted through HR. It's got to go through the union MOU. Like you've got to go find the LTD program that might pick her up, because most American workers, women in the U.S. might have Social Security, and when you have Social Security, you get that 55% pay, which is short-term disability. That's built into your paycheck. We don't have anything like that. So our women will go on leave, use up every day of their leave accruals, and then they will have to go on AWOP, absent without pay. And then they still have to pay their mortgage and their utility bills, and they're trying to raise a baby.
Right.
So this is another reason women leave. It's not only a major obstacle in their success, but if you don't have a massive infrastructure like parents, you can't even get childcare that'll do a 48-hour shift. Nannies, you know, unless you have a live-in nanny, most of us can't afford that.
Right.
You don't have,
So, or you're proximal to family who are committed to you. And
yeah, we all know it. And you said the magic word a few minutes ago, Mando. Like, when you're out of control of your own schedule, it makes parenting very challenging, especially when they're little, especially when they're not old enough to speak for themselves. So your very little kids, your babies and your toddlers, and it's just a precious time in life that you don't want to miss. And if you miss a birthday or a Christmas, you're like, oh man, what am I doing here? I'm gonna go work for the public works agency or something. I'm gonna go be a postal carrier. I gotta go.
Right.
So as cool as this job is, there are some major disadvantages.
Yeah.
And I think that women, those experiences are magnified for women just because the mama role with the babies.
Yeah.
And it's just, I know that that's very gender biased for me to say that, but mothers and their children, we pretty much, most of our men out there are counting on their wives to take care of things while they're gone. They got a subject matter expert at home raising the kids.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's just a different, when that dichotomy and when it's shifted, it's a big contrast.
Yeah. Well, and I know it's gender bias, which you said, right? Like, but if you don't acknowledge it, we can do, wow, there's no women in the fire service.
Man.
Well, let's talk about why that is.
Yeah.
Here's an example of what variables exist that put pressure on women who want to be in the fire service.
Yeah. Small disclaimer. I have lived in Berkeley, California for 26 years, and I went to UC Berkeley. So pretty much if I walk in on a stage in a pantsuit, people are like, oh, here she comes. I got this Berkeley chick coming to tell me how it's going to be.
Yeah.
But no, I know I do say things that are not going to jive with everybody, and I don't acknowledge things. I didn't even, in my thesis, I did not even address non-binary firefighters. Hmm. It was just too big for me to touch. I felt like it was a massive distractor. And I know that it's like, I know our friends in Oakland, I definitely have close colleagues within my own local that are dealing with this and their identities and how they want to be known. And we're trying to be respectful and learn it. And I don't mean to discourage or underplay their experience.
Yeah.
And I've got actual firefighters whose children are going through the experience themselves.
Yeah.
So it's very real. And I had to make some kind of a boundary in my research process about how I was going to narrow it down. Because obviously I'm trying to eat an elephant here, right? It's a big topic.
Yeah. It's only 4%.
Dude, I know. You know what?
So what's the fourth gate?
Promotional obstacles.
Okay.
And those have to do with a lot of interesting things. Women, just like I was talking about that rite of passage, we get them in, we boot camp them, and then we bring them out, but we just drop them off on the other side.
Yeah.
There's a big emphasis, especially with LA Fire, Chief Taraz's conversation, recruit more women. Yeah, but what are you going to do with them once you get them, right? Like, are you really going to make sure they're integrated into your firehouse, into your culture?
Yeah.
Is there a place for them to sleep? Is there a place for them to shower with a door lock? Is there a place for them not to get raped in their bunk? Because guess what? I'm sorry to report, it is happening at very high numbers. Mm. Sexual assault, sexual abuse.
Yeah.
And I don't just mean in the firehouse, but I mean in the app bay, and I mean in the after parties and the Christmas parties and the union events. Women at conferences, women tell me all the time, I don't go to conferences. Yeah, I'm not trying to be the only woman at a conference. And I myself was sharing yesterday at the Women's Symposium. I was like, man, I had to raise my hand. It's happened to me. Like, I've opened my door at night with somebody with their pants down at the hotel. Just, I'm like, oh, you just got back from the strip club and you knew I was here, right? This is what the conference culture is like, right?
Yeah.
So here's why that's a problem. Women who don't get that extra training, they don't get to meet people from other agencies and have like mind melding experiences. They don't get to see what other people's policies and procedures are, learn other people's OAGs and SOPs, right? Get their hands on new pieces of tools and equipment and learn about fire technology. Like women who aren't pursuing that, like lust for learning, because they're too busy managing their own survival, they're missing out on the opportunities that actually put you in that gradient above the competitors when you go to take a promotional exam.
Right.
Bids are a problem too. The bid blocking. A lot of American Fire Service agencies and Canadian Fire Service agencies have like selective bids. It means you can bid a house, which means I have to go and court you and say, hey, Captain Gray, you know, I want to work at your station. Here are my calls and credentials. And then you'll be like, oh, make me a filet mignon. You know, like, let me see your free throw skills, right? You can make all these kind of arbitrary obstacles, like games that we play to say, man, if you don't play baseball, you can't work here because this is a baseball house,
right?
We golf together after work, or, you know what I mean? Like, so you can keep your little...
To be clear, there's so many firehouses that are SEAL Team 6, okay?
Oh, yeah, I know.
The elite.
Totally, the elite. The elite. You're not... If all your stuff is not tactical... You're just not going to fly here, man. I don't think you fit in. I just don't think you're a good fit.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's how this happens for people who are like the unpopular kids at school and the women. I'm just going to lump them in the same category. You can block bids, right, for those individuals. You can say you're not a good fit. Oh, we got our eye on somebody else.
Yeah.
And here's where one of the ways that we call ourselves paramilitary, but we're not actually honoring the military's model, is that if you get deployed in the military, you work with who you're stationed with.
Yeah.
You go to war with the army you got, not the army you want. In the fire service, we get to pick and choose and go, no, that's my boy. He was in my academy, or, you know, that's my brother-in-law, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You can pick your house. And it's one of the best things about the job because you can work with your friends. And then it's just like the lunatics running the asylum. Right. I've had that crew. I've had great crews where I'm like, I can't believe we're allowed to drive this $750,000 apparatus, listen to whatever music we want, show up and save some people's lives and go back and make a delicious dinner. I mean, who doesn't love that life, right? But I'm looking at it now from like as a parent and in a leadership role.
Yeah.
And man, there's a heavy liability if you're allowing systems like that to take place where people who have quals and credentials are not being promoted on the basis of their merit. Mm. We have to recruit on the basis of merit, and then we have to continue growing and promoting people on their merits. Like, so you got to acknowledge it. If they've done the work and they're qualified for it, what happens as a result of them not being able to get into good houses, and that's like the battalion houses, the truck houses, the rescue houses. In California, rescue refers to heavy rescue, not not the ambulance. I'm in my part of California anyway.
Cappy.
But yeah, I don't mean, no one's fighting to get on the ambulance. We all know that. But yeah, all the girls are allowed to work on the ambulance anytime they want. That's my experience. But you're limiting their promotional opportunities because they don't get the exposure and the experience. They're not driving the tiller, and they're not going on the big, multi-alarms, and they're not doing confined space rescues, and they're not getting the working experience that they get. So those desirable locations get locked down with the cool kids. And I think this is probably a common experience for a lot of us in the fire service. That I know very amazing and well-qualified men who have been denied bids just because they're not cool, you know, they're not cool enough.
Right. They get waved off.
They're not tactical enough.
Yeah,
they get waved off. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's hurtful. And so that stuff are all these little like the death by a thousand cuts. It's all these little things that will lead to a person leaving the job early and will leave to a person giving up, surrendering, you know, and just realizing like, I'm never going to fit in. And so they go and work at a slow house. And then that and enhances their reputation of being a slug or not good enough. Well, you've only ever worked at this slow house. It's like, man, I could never get in anywhere else besides that slow house, right? At least they were nice to me there. And I had some sovereignty. Anyway, the promotional gate has to do with implicit bias. It has to do with like, you know, nepotism issues. I don't see you as a leader. Like, people don't have a mental image of women in chief or leadership roles. So even like now when I go out in my uniform, people are like, what do you do? Are you a cop? Like, people can't even perceive that I'm a fire chief, right?
Right.
It's unknown. It's an unknown. Yeah. And so in the minds of our own firefighters, if you haven't been raised up by women in your life. You hadn't had strong women in your schools or in your sports that you played or in the military. If you never seen female officers, you don't think of me as, you know, you're like, oh, you'd probably be nice as an admin assistant.
Well, when you talk about implicit bias, it's a very important topic, right? That piece shapes how we view the entire world and causes us to put people in a box that may or may not be appropriate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you talk about not identifying somebody as a fire chief because they're a woman. Like, we don't see you in that role. I don't get it. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, the community, I get it in the community, right? But inside of our own house, inside of our own organizations, we have to understand that just because someone's different, we have to recognize our own bias, I guess, is what I'm headed with this, right? We have to be curious about what it is that we're thinking and why we're thinking these things about people. You know, so many times I'll be like, oh yeah, I heard about Heather. Never worked with her, but I already have thoughts and feelings about her.
Yeah, you're building that ID.
Oh yeah, I've got a case against her. Mm-hmm. She can't come here. Mm-hmm. What do you mean she can't come here? Oh yeah, I know all these things about her.
Well, I did that to you yesterday. I said, tell me about Rain Gray. I only heard nice things. So.
Well,
but we all do it, and it makes sense. It's a survival mechanism.
100%.
How do I act around this person? How am I going to be? Is this the kind of chick that's going to be watching me and she's going to be writing me up? Is she taking notes on my behavior? I can tell you that I am sometimes around other women that I think they're going to write me up.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like they make me uncomfortable. So I know what that feels like. But you know, when you're under a magnifying glass, and women, because they're a super minority within the organization, they always have that experience of, I don't know if you've ever like walked into a room, or if you go to foreign countries, this is a great example. If you've ever walked into the room and been the only, I was in Morocco during the World Cup, and I have the greatest metaphor for this moment. When the jukebox stops, when you walk into the room, oh, I didn't know that women are not allowed into like these cafes where the men drink tea and watch soccer.
Okay. Football, you mean?
Yes, I do mean that. I don't even know how that translates into Arabic, but yes, it is football. They were watching the World Cup and I wanted to see the score and I was traveling, right? Like, so I saw the TV through the window and I opened the door and I popped my little blonde head in the door and man, dude, everybody just went
uncovered head.
Boy, all those opium pipes and all those teacups just clattered. They were like, you do not belong here. And so, you know, that feeling when you like walk into a room and you're like, I'm not wanted here.
Yeah.
I'm not wanted here. Yeah. I think there's a lot of people that are going through that on a daily basis. And so it makes the job, when we talk about recruitment, these things are deterrents for recruitment because all you have to do is look up some headlines and you go, dang, women firefighters, all the news is bad. It's like lawsuit, swastikas in their locker, tampering with their gear, you know, female firefighters sue the county of, or sexting tape comes out, or it's all bad news, right? Like when you look it up.
Right.
And then you go try to find some data. You go try to say, well, how many women are there? How many women chiefs are there? We're not really sure. But it appears that out of 380,000 career firefighters in America, that there are about 160 female chief officers.
From like
the
battalion,
universe.
Like battalion up?
From battalion chief to fire chief.
Wow.
Only 160.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would represent a super minority in this country.
Yeah.
That's a weird feeling.
Yeah.
That's a heavy load. And guess what? That magnifying glass. Everything I say, I mean, things I say today will be analyzed.
Oh yeah,
right. And so, but I have just had to learn. Like, I am very fearless about speaking and sharing because I do know I have a unique role, a unique opportunity, and I know I can reach to people. I did the Women in the Fire Service, as Fire Nuggets hosted Women's Symposium yesterday. Women in the Fire Service was present, but that was through Fire Nuggets, and it was here in Arizona. That's why I'm here today. But it was really cool to be in a room of 150 women. About 40% of them were brand new, under 5 years experience, like all of our fire services, about under 5 years experience. But to see all those young bloods in the room was great. But they came from 17 states to come to a one-day conference.
Wow.
And drinking beers with them in the evening around the fireplace, I was like, it was very, very great feeling to be an OG at this point. And then I'm only 18 years in. That's not even that impressive. But that makes you old in our career these days.
Yeah.
But to hear them say, I felt so alone and I didn't know there were other people like me. And I was like, this is where the network gets built. And this is how, I mean, a lot of us do our friendships, male or female, a lot of us have our closest friends in other agencies. You know, maybe that right. family network, maybe all your drama is coming from inside your own firehouse or fire station. Well, then don't put all the weight on it. Don't make that, don't make them be your everything.
Yeah.
Like, reach out and keep your friendships outside of work alive, and keep your network in your other agencies and other states. Call and say, man, what do you do when this happens? Because I promise you, your friend at LA Fire or Chicago Fire or Charlotte, North, you know, North Carolina is going to answer the question for you. They've seen it already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. So
the women had the chance to build that yesterday. I was awesome. Happy to see that.
No, that's great. And it's because it's such a, you know, such a tiny minority within the fire service, the opportunity you guys have to come together and just share, hey, what are some of the issues that we're facing that are unique? And you point out in that paper, some, you know, those gates alone are incredibly specific elements that women are dealing with. Now, there's carryover. And I think that as organizational leaders, we have to be listening. This is really, really important to me. This is part of why I have this podcast in the first place, is to start this conversation so that we can listen to one another. And if we're not listening to the voices in our organization about what their needs are and what their concerns are, then are we leading? What are we leading? Right? We're just going to lead SOPs. Hey, this is the rules. Follow the rules. Yeah. But what? How are we growing? What are we doing? Building more fire stations, hiring more firefighters. Yeah. Okay, great. But what are we doing for our people? Because frankly, the most important commodity that we have is our personnel. Mm. And they are incredibly complex and sophisticated, and they have needs to be successful. Mm. And when we talk about recruitment and retention, we're not going to, if our environment isn't healthy and robust and thoughtful and caring and nurturing, people will leave because they have other options. Mm-hmm. And we have to recognize that. People are like, and that's what people, rah, they throw their fists up and go, why would anybody leave the fire service? You know, this is the best place ever, greatest career ever. I don't disagree. However, people have choices and they're going to exercise their choices.
Yeah.
And when these gates are complex and they're like, well, you got to give me a good reason to stay here. It's got to be really good.
Yes.
The pay, the benefits, the culture.
Yes.
Has to be healthy.
Yes.
So when you talk about the, and I've watched this throughout my entire career, when people get boxed out of a certain station, even when it's fully, it's 100% seniority based, they go, hey, Heather, really appreciate your interest, but you know, Bob's been here on a long-term temp and you know, he just really fits. He gets us.
And we're working on these ladders together. You know, we got to finish that project. It's going to take at least a year.
And the subtext is, if you put in Heather, we will ruin you.
Yes, that's what that means. It's a tacit warning. It's your opportunity to self-eliminate.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right about that. And that, again, another thing. Everything we've talked about today, it affects all of us.
Yeah.
And the other part that affects all of us is that we're all participating in it.
Yeah.
So you are participating in the how people are recruited and how they're physically training. And you're participating in your behavior at the dining table and how your wife treats the new girl at work, or whether you're not allowed to bid at a station because a woman works there. Oh my God, I can't believe that. And then whether or not you're willing to work for a female leader. Like, I'm not going to bid her shift. I'm not working for a woman. Wait a minute. You guys were friends when you're in the academy. And now, you know, now she's a company officer and you can't see her that way.
Right.
Or you can't take those orders. And the maternity and pregnancy leave, that will benefit everyone. We're making future firefighters. There is such a small percent of women in the fire service. Of that small percent, only a smaller percent will ever make babies.
Yeah.
If they make babies, they'll only make one or two. The cost to your agency is minimal. The policies are a legal standard. And the behavior around how we treat pregnancy, not like, oh, is she pregnant again? You know, I hear all the time, like, oh my gosh, she's making a human being. Like, you just had a shoulder injury, you punk, from like, you know, your skateboarding accident.
Right.
And she's making a human being. So she's going to be gone a few months. Give her some grace, you know?
Yeah.
So there's departments out there. I got to shout to Dallas, because they take such good care of pregnant women. They really honor the fact that, like, hey, we're gonna protect you and your baby during this pregnancy, and we're gonna give you all the things you need to come back to work when you're done, including PT, you know, physical training to make sure your body's ready.
That's awesome.
And so that affects all of us. And parental leave policies, those are gender neutral. Those for dads too. That's for baby bonding too. And when I talk to retirees, obviously when I did my history book, I met a lot of retirees and reached way in the Wayback Machine. And when I listened to them talk about things they regretted in the course of their career, I heard this lament from older men about missing their kids' childhoods. And I blew it with my kid because I still can't connect to my son because, or I broke my daughter's heart because, and they really recognized they spent so much time at work and they missed those childhood times.
Yeah.
So we're seeing now in that 5-year departure, you're talking about a lot more conversation about work-life balance, which is super healthy, but it's also not, it's not really conducive to our model, which is I have constant staffing and I need butts in seats. And if you don't come to work, you're actually screwing your buddy because he just got mandated in your spot. Right. And that creates the infighting, right? That's bad. And I know you're dealing with that one.
Oh, I get it.
Everybody
that's
is.
Awesome.
We all are. These are universals.
Well, I'm going to pull us to a close here because we both have places to be together. You got to catch a plane and I got to go teach a class. So let me ask you a question. I'm going to ask you a couple rapid fire questions.
Go ahead.
Okay. Hold on. Let me think of what I want to ask you. What's your favorite piece of advice that you like to give?
To anybody in the world?
Yeah.
Or just firefighters?
Well, I don't care. Anybody. Interpret how you will.
Oh my gosh. Be easy to love. Follow the love. What I mean by that and how it applies to us is likability and credibility, they go hand in hand. Mm. And if you are a learner or a teacher, it's really important that you're lovable. And I know it is cheesy, but literally that's my model and how I kind of frame my life every day. I think how, because I love my people, how can I follow the love? How do I do the thing that's best for them? How can I make this next policy change that's going to benefit them and their families and their longevity and their wellness? I'm not scared to bring my femininity to the fire service. I'm not scared to bring a sense of love into this family.
Cool. I love that. Okay. What's your favorite thing to eat in the firehouse?
Dude, I worked with this guy named Francisco and I every time I cook, I still think about him. Okay, we do steak and Caesar on Friday nights.
Okay.
I don't miss it. Francisco's tacos for sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Last question. The name of this podcast is the Fireground Fitness Podcast, mm-hmm. which can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. Mm-hmm. What does being Fireground Fit mean to you?
I love the title and I love how you've expanded it. One of the things about our job is that we are just masters of so many things, but our physical fitness and our operational readiness, that has to do with a state of mind, and a state of battle readiness that we all have to undergo. So it's how we wake up every morning. It's how we frame our day and it's how we perform. So that Fireground Fitness model, to me, I love it that you've pulled in behavioral health and wellness and that you've pulled in the sociocultural dynamics of how we communicate, how we integrate, how we communicate through our chain of command, how we are led, how we do servant leadership. To be fit for duty in my mind, it is completely an awareness that no one's coming for you. And you're the person that got the call. So you have to be ready to handle everything. And you really need to take care of yourself to make sure you're able to help others.
Perfect. I love that.
Yeah.
Heather, thank you so much for your time.
Dude, you're super fun to hang out with. Anytime.
The feeling is mutual.
Call me on your commute, man. I love talking to you. It's great.
Heather, thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's all we have for today, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in. Heather, thank you for sharing your time and talents. If you are enjoying this podcast, get on over to Apple Podcasts, rate and review the podcast. That helps with folks finding their way through the internet to this content. Additionally, whatever platform you enjoy most, get on over there, subscribe, and this podcast will drop in the middle of the night when you least expect it. Lastly, if you have any questions, comments, you want to share some thoughts or feelings, feel free to reach out to me on any social media platform, whether it be Instagram, whether it be Facebook, or feel free to drop me an email at raingray@firegroundfitness.com. All right, folks, take some lessons you've learned here today. Go out, imbue them in your life. Kick ass, take names, and get after it. Go on now, get some.